So last week, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WILL, filed a lawsuit against Governor Tony Evers, claiming the governor does not have the authority to extend a state of emergency. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn. In for Kate Archer-Kent, she returns tomorrow. And WILL also filed an amicus brief in support of the lawsuit that ended the governor's Safer at Home order back in May. Do you think it's time to end Wisconsin's mask mandate? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to the studio, or email ideas@wpr.org for your questions for our next guest. Rick Essenberg is the president and general counsel at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Rick, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me. Good morning.
And so what's your case as you file this in the courts? What are you saying about the governor's mask mandate? Why should it be removed?
Well, we're not saying really anything about the mask mandate itself. Our clients who live in Polk County claim to have been injured by the imposition of the mandate in that county where they don't believe it's necessary. But that's not the issue that the court will be asked to decide. The court will be asked to decide what the extent of the governor's power is to declare a public emergency. So if you look at our laws say that the governor can declare an emergency. It can be a public health emergency or it can be a disaster emergency. But his or her ability to do that is time limited. An emergency can only last for 60 days, and the governor does not have the power under state statute to extend it. It can only be extended by a joint resolution of the legislature, and even the legislature can only extend it for another 60 days.
Rick, isn't this the same case that was made against the governor's Safer at Home order?
No. Governor's Safer at Home order, what happened there was the governor declared a public health emergency in early March of this year. In early May, it was set to appear. Now, back then, he understood that he did not have the power to extend it. And so what he attempted to do is extend his Safer at Home order, not by using his emergency powers, but by using another provision in the law called Chapter 252, which gives the Department of Health Services certain powers to control the spread of infectious disease. And what the court ruled in May was that if the Department of Health Services wanted to extend the stay-at-home order, it had to proceed by what is called rulemaking, which you make a rule, you have to refer to the statutory authority that you have to make the rule, you have to have public notice and comment, and the legislature has the ability to suspend that rule. The governor didn't want to do that, and so the Safer at Home went away. He could have. He started the process of making rulemaking, but he abandoned it. Similarly, with this mask mandate, if he wanted to start the rulemaking process to impose a statewide mask mandate, he could do that. Our lawsuit doesn't have anything to do with that. But the problem for the governor is that if he did that, he would have to provide public notice and comment. The legislature would have the ability to block the mandate, and he might not get the statewide mandate that he wants. And so because he doesn't want to go through the legally permissible process, he has decided that he is going to declare a second public health emergency arising from the COVID pandemic. And our lawsuit says that's the thing that you can't do because your ability to declare a public health emergency is limited to 60 days by statute. And our statute simply doesn't contemplate giving the governor the power to declare one emergency after another arising from the same underlying set of facts and use that to rule by decree.
Rick Essenberg, our guest. He's a president and general counsel at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. They've got a case that is, in essence, the end result could be the end of the statewide mask mandate. And Rick, you make a case that this is the law in Wisconsin. But we also have a legislature that has not been active in the lawmaking process, at least going back for, 4 months now, if not more. They have gaveled in. They do have the opportunity to take up issues today. But do you see how this legal wrangling could fly in the face of what has become a largely public consensus about public health?
Well, again, you can criticize the legislature if you want for not acting. And in some ways, I have been critical of the legislature for not acting. But here's the problem. The fact that the officials that we elect won't do what we want them to do does not mean that we can ignore our state constitution and we can ignore our law. We still have to follow the rules. And if you look at what the legal structure that has been laid out, the governor is given power to act, extraordinary power to act, in the course of an emergency. During that emergency, the governor can enter any order to protect person or property. I mean, given the fact that he's declared an emergency now.
But you're saying this is not an emergency anymore, at least by the books.
Well, right, because what the law does is it says, look, you can declare an emergency and you can rule by decree in order to respond to that emergency, but we're only going to give you 60 days to do it. And the reason that we do that is it's that, you know, we understand that there may be situations in which a governor has to act immediately and there's no time to get the legislature together. And so under those circumstances, we're going to suspend the rules. We're going to allow something that we typically don't allow, and that is the governor to issue orders, rule by decree, make law, but only for that 60-day period. And then, after that point, we have to return to regular constitutional order.
And that's the way it is by the book. And, Rick, I do have a question coming in here. I want to invite others to participate in the conversation with you, President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And the phone number here is, and the question is clear. And Rick makes the case that this is the way the law is in Wisconsin. I am not licensed to practice law in this or any other state of mine. But how does that contrast with the reality on the ground now as you see it in Wisconsin? And take your calls and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. John from Menominee, he emailed to ask why Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty is making political points during an unprecedented pandemic. His words, he's 69 years old, and he says he's never seen anything like this. He says people are dying. But for your perspective, Rick, this is about executive overreach. This is about what government will be. But how does that fit within the context of a public health crisis that we're seeing play out nationwide?
Well, because, I mean, we can argue about, you know, what difference, if any, a mask mandate would actually have. But our courts have made clear that there's no pandemic exception to our Constitution and the rule of law. And in fact, one can make the case that when we are frightened of something, right, when we think that something is a threat, that's when our constitutional guardrails and the rule of law become the most important, because every
is that like the war on terror? Is that like in the aftermath of September 11th? Do you draw a parallel there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we were very afraid of terror, and I think in some circumstances we lost sight of what the rule of law requires. And, you know, if you look historically, that's always a danger.
And fear is certainly a common thread that goes from then till now. And our guest, Rick Essenberg, is President and General Counsel at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Their lawsuit may overturn Wisconsin's mask mandate. What will the impact of that be? And what do you think about the case? 1-800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Our conversation with Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty continues. I'm Lee Rayburn on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. According to the AARP, there are 34 states and the District of Columbia that currently have some form of mandated face coverings in public. That number may soon be reduced by one if the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty gets its way in our courts. And our guest is the president and general counsel of WIL, and he says this is just in accordance with Wisconsin law. What does that say about Wisconsin law? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show with Rick Essenberg, our guest from the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And Rick, you had mentioned the fact that this was a case that began because your client, the plaintiff in this case, was injured in Polk County. What's the injury that you were seeking recourse from here?
So in any lawsuit, right, the plaintiff has to be able to allege that they have been injured by the thing that they complain of.
What's the injury?
In our instance, our clients say that they are injured because they are subject to a mask mandate. They live in Polk County. There's very little incident of COVID infection in Polk County. And to require them to wear masks under certain circumstances is something that they regard as unnecessary and an infringement on their liberty. That's enough of an injury to get them into court. But again, I have to say that the issue before the court has to do with the governor's emergency power. It doesn't have to do with the merits of a mask mandate. And to be honest with you, it doesn't even have to do with whether there are other ways that the governor could impose a mask mandate. There are other things he could do. He could go to the legislature and he could ask them to impose a mask mandate or to authorize one.
Hasn't he done that, though?
Or he could invoke, is another thing he could do. Well, if he's done it and the legislature has said no, that's not a problem with Wisconsin law. That is the law working the way that it has. Sometimes the law doesn't give you what you want. That doesn't mean that the law is wrong as a result of it. But there's another thing he could do. He could invoke the rulemaking process. He could cite to statutory authority that gives him the power to respond to an infectious disease, and he could make a rule. But the problem is, and I think the reason that he hasn't done it, is that other people would have to be involved. He would have to have a public notice and comment period. The JCRIR, which is a joint committee on rules and regulations, legislative ability to suspend that. Well, I don't know whether they would. They haven't suspended his emergency. But the problem is that he, for the governor, I think, is that he wouldn't be able to act unilaterally. And for whatever reason, this governor wants to act unilaterally. He wants to act without input from others. And he simply doesn't have the authority to do that under state law. And if state law did give him that authority, it would be unconstitutional because it would essentially permit the governor to rule by decree anytime he declares an emergency. And if you look at our statutes, Lee, an emergency could be anything. It could be crime in the streets. It could be illegal immigration. The ability of a governor to declare an emergency is extremely broad. And so we should be very, very careful about how we interpret it, because the one thing that we know is we have a Democratic governor today. We will have a Republican governor at some point in the future. There is going to be a governor you don't like. And so you should be concerned about what the rules provide for.
Rick Essenberg, our guest, taking questions from you at 1-800-642-1234. Judy in Verona, you're on the Ideas Network with Rick Essenberg from the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Good morning.
Good morning. The Wisconsin conservative legislators have refused to act on the pandemic. They won't meet. They gavel in, they gavel out. Asking them to do anything and get out of their home situation and away from their little computers gets you nowhere. The governor is asking just for people to wear masks. It's not a hard thing. I don't understand why people won't do it. People are dying. Masks saves lives. And I think you don't have to take on this lawsuit. You know, it's going to cut into your budget maybe a little, but you seem to be making a lot of money off all these lawsuits at your institute. And frankly, I don't know how you look at yourself in the mirror each morning. That's all.
Judy? You didn't have to take the lawsuit, I guess, is the takeaway there, Rick. Why did you choose to take the...
I'm not, I'm not going to respond to the caller's cheap pejoratives, but she's wrong, incidentally, about the Republican legislature. There was a bipartisan bill that was passed in April that enacted a number of responses to the COVID legislation. Her concern is that the legislature won't do certain things that she wants it to do. That's not a bug of our Constitution.
Well, I apologize for our caller, Rick. And so let me rephrase here. The concern here is that we have a partisan political system that may be endangering lives in Wisconsin. And that partisan political system has, for some, failed them. We're talking about a public health crisis right now. And we're also talking about executive overreach at a time when certainly discussions about the government powers are being debated right now and what executives can do at any level of government. It's a debate worth having. But in the context of your work, Rick, with the Wisconsin Institute and Law and Liberty, the one thing that keeps coming up is your role in the partisanship of Wisconsin. John Kraft, as I understand, is one of the plaintiffs in this lawsuit. John Kraft is the Republican Party chairman for St. Croix County. So how do you dispel the concerns that this is part of the partisan politics that is failing our public health right now in Wisconsin?
Well, first of all, there are going to be disagreements about how to respond to a public health crisis, right? So there's a roiling public debate over whether lockdowns work. And believe it or not, there's even a public debate about the efficacy of mask mandates. I mean, there are people who have tried to statistically discern the impact of the mask mandate since this, since it was imposed about a month ago, and it doesn't look like, actually there has been any impact because the positivity rate has remained the same. But let's put that all aside. Our system presupposes that, power is divided. The legislature has a certain role. The governor has a certain role. Sometimes they'll disagree. To dismiss that as a partisan conflict is simply to assume that your side is correct and the other side is wrong. And that's not the way that our system works. What we're insisting on is that the rules be followed. There are ways the governor could pursue a mask mandate if he wanted to. He could even do it by himself through rulemaking. But what he can't do is he can't declare emergencies in series and, as a result of that, rule by decree. And it's not a partisan point because this rule would apply to any governor, Republican or Democrat. And what we're trying to do is say, look, we got to stick to the rules no matter what policy preference we want and no matter what party we belong to.
Let's go to Michelle in Wanakee. Michelle, good morning. You are on the Ideas Network with Rick Eisenberg from the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty.
Hi, I'm a ventilator nurse, and I want to know what responsibility you feel towards the general public with fighting the mask mandate and basically putting the general public's health at risk. This is a deadly disease, and there's no known cure. And some people will only be slightly affected, and some will be, some will lose their lives.
Michelle, as a medical practitioner, I want to stop you and ask you about whether or not you think masks are medically important, if you think they are important as part of dealing with a pandemic, and if you think the safer at home order or the quarantine was effective in controlling the pandemic.
I'll ask you a question. Would you want your surgeon to not wear a mask? It's a respiratory transmitted disease. So masks, I think, are essential. Quarantine, I think, is very important. I understand I'm an essential worker, so I understand that not everybody can stay home. But this is a deadly condition, and we have no idea what the long-term consequences of this is going to be. Chickenpox, not so bad. I don't know of anyone who's had shingles who said that it's a walk in the park. And we've already seen through cardiac MRIs heart damage in a majority of people. I'm not talking about just people who are hospitalized. I'm talking the majority of these people in this study were not hospitalized. They had cardiac MRIs. 78 of them had cardiac changes.
Michelle, I appreciate your call and your work. On the flip side, I do have an email here from Bill from Superior who called to commend the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty for doing the lawsuit. He says that people need to understand that the governor doesn't have unlimited power. But Rick, could the governor have, the law says the governor gets a 60 days for emergency. Does the law say he can't issue multiple subsequent 60-day declarations?
Well, I mean, I think it does because the problem here is that clearly our legislature, not the current legislature, but the legislature that enacted this many, many years ago, intended that government's emergency, the governor's emergency powers to be time limited, limited to 60 days. Now, if you allow the governor to declare emergencies in series one after another, then you render that time limitation on the power of the governor to act by decree meaningless. And that can't be the way that the law is interpreted. And if you do interpret the law that way, then I think you have a serious constitutional problem, because our Constitution says that the legislature makes the law and the governor administers the law. It does not give the governor the power to rule by decree. We do not elect a dictator every 4 years who, you know, gets to tell us what to do. That's not the way our system works. And look, I'm not here to debate the efficacy of a mask mandate and whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. Quite frankly, 95% of people where I live were wearing masks in public places before this mandate was ever put.
Rick, I apologize. We're out of time, but I always appreciate your time. And thank you for making the case this morning with us.
Nah, thank you. Take care.
Rick Esenberg, President and General Counsel at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Up next, news. Then we'll talk with protester Frank Nitti, who recently returned from Washington, D.C. after his march on Washington, along with so many others. I'm Lee Rayburn. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network, and if you haven't noticed yet, we've made some changes beginning at the start of the week, and we want you to check them out and let us know what you think. We made them for you anyway, so it's new to us. Our Neighbors 1A with Jen White follows The Morning Show now here on the Ideas Network, and you can hear this live nationwide show from 9 to 11 weekdays on the Ideas Network. For those who are expecting On Point following us here in the morning, it's moved to 1 o'clock in the afternoon during the week following Chapter a Day, which is wrapping up today with Northland from Porter Fox, by the way. So check out the changes. Let us know what you think online at WPR.org/fall2020. So how far are you willing to go for what you believe in? It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, filling in for Kate Archer-Kent. Frank Nitti Sensabaugh has been at the forefront of the Black Lives Matter protests in Milwaukee for months, years. Recently, he just got back from marching to Washington, D.C., walked to Washington, D.C. so he could march on Washington on the anniversary of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech on the Washington Mall. What's next for the Black Lives Matter movement in Wisconsin? And what would you like to see? 1-800-642-1234. Email available for you, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Frank Nitti, a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you guys for having me this morning. It means a lot when platforms I normally don't speak to reach out and give me an opportunity. It really means a lot to me.
Well, you just got back home from Milwaukee. What was it? Tuesday night. You'd spent the last 3 weeks walking 750 miles from Wisconsin to the District of Columbia to take part in a rally of tens of thousands on the 57th anniversary of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. What got you walking and what made you march? Tell us about what got you moving all the way to D.C., Frank.
So we had already been marching for in Milwaukee. We had marched for George Floyd, and we had marched for about 60-something days. So when I first heard about the George Floyd protests in Washington, D.C., I knew I wanted to go. A lot of activists wanted to go. Everyone was talking about going. So I knew it was something I wanted to go to. Right, even before they picked the date, they had just said they were going to do it. I had read about it, and people had started to, like, get ready to go. When I found out it was on the same day that Dr. King gave his 57th year that Dr. King gave his I Have a Dream speech, I was like, man, I just had an idea just cross my mind really quick. It was like, it'd be cool if somebody walked all the way there, you know what I mean? And I was like, man, I wonder if anybody's going to do that, you know what I mean? It started like that. So then I always tell people, once I put it on Facebook, I was stuck, you know what I mean? So I made a Facebook post, and I was like, they're never going to let me live this down if I don't do it now. Like, that was how I committed.
You're going
to
need
it.
A good,
like,
pair of shoes, Frank.
Yeah. That magical Facebook post was, like, literally how I committed myself. And I literally did no press, no news, anything. And I made the Facebook post, and it was, like, in the journal. It was everywhere. I was like, oh, man, I definitely have to go. But, no, I prayed about it. And I knew that I didn't know why I needed to walk. I didn't know why I was going to walk. I didn't know what to expect on the journey. I just knew, like, I wanted to honor Dr. King. And once I prayed about it, I was like, man, this is something I'm really going to do. And then I set out to do it. And that's how it began. It was just, I wanted to honor him and George Floyd at the same time. I wanted to keep the streak going because we had already been walking for like 60 something days in a row. And I also had felt like at that time we had been doing like 15, 20 miles in Milwaukee every day, just walking in circles. I was like, man, we could do this. I kind of underestimated the trip, but that was the premise of it in my head that,
sure.
that yeah, we've been already walking all these miles.
And you'd had a summer's worth of practice beginning with the death of George Floyd and the protests that started and never stopped. And I should make that clear, although the coverage sometimes might have disappeared, the marching in the streets has not stopped all summer long. Our guest is Frank Nitti, and he took that march all the way to Washington, D.C., and is now back home again in Milwaukee. What would you like to know about what's next for the Black Lives Matter movement? 1-800-642-1234. Ann in Madison, you're on the Ideas Network with Frank Nitti. Good morning.
Hi, I'm so glad to be able to talk to you, and I'm glad that Frank is there. So, you know, I don't know everything about everything that's been going on regarding Black Lives Matter, but because I've been busy with COVID. But my question for a long time has been, what is the first step that we need to take? Like, I'm not saying we have to stop the marches or the protests, but to take the anger out of it and take the violence out, what can we do? What's the first step that you would like to do that maybe isn't happening?
Frank?
I think that one main misconception is you have, you know how people always say, well, there's only a few bad police that are doing all this stuff. It's unfortunate that that works for the police, but then when it comes to protesting, those few bad people always make people say, what do we have to do to take the violence out? When you look at the protests, like 99% of them are, and that's the number I just made up, just so you know, don't look for that number. But a large percentage of them, like over 90% for sure, are nonviolent protests. You have rioters and you have protesters. So those are two separate groups. A lot of times the media likes to group them together for their own personal reasons. But you have peaceful protesters. So if you watch any of the protests that I've done for the last 100 days, they've all been peaceful. So there has been no violence in them. So we don't do that. We don't burn stuff down. We don't wreck stuff. We're nonviolent. So a lot of times I think what happens is the media only shows the violent stuff. They only show the riots. They only show the fires. And I always tell people they're kind of important as well. Not to say it like that, but Showtime was here yesterday for the show The Circus, and they wanted to interview me about the Seville Smith incident and the unrest that happened with that. And the thing was, Jay Anderson was killed maybe like a month before that, and they were peacefully protesting Mayfair Mall, and they got no media attention. And then someone burned down a gas station and the world news was here. So sometimes it's kind of hard to like say only be peaceful when the only time the media actually covers a story is when something gets burned down. And I think the other part of that is some people feel like a lot of people are uneducated about the entire movement and the way that things go. So a lot of times they'll see people burning stuff down on TV and they'll think, well, that's how I contribute. They'll think that's the way that they contribute. They honestly think, some of the young people think, well, I need to go out and throw a brick, or I need to go out and throw a rock, because all they see is this is what people are doing across the country because that's the way the media is portraying it, which is another misconception.
Well, let me just say on the media's behalf, and don't quote me on this, 99% of them are pretty good.
Right.
So, I get your point that if there isn't video footage, it's not going to show up on the evening news because there's nothing to see. And there is a case to be made there, Frank Nitti, for certain. But you took your shoes and you walked all the way to Washington, D.C. And the one thing that Ann called in to say is about the anger. And the one thing that you found as you were walking across the country was anger. People were angry at you, Frank.
Exactly.
And so it doesn't matter what side you're on. People are angry, people are afraid, and people want to know what they can do to be less angry and less afraid.
It's kind of difficult because the people that were angry at us, we didn't do anything but walk. A lot of times we weren't even in Black Lives Matter, and they were like, get out the road, spook, get out the road, N-word, you effing N-word, don't belong here. They threw food at us. They threw boots at us. One of my friends got shot from a white supremacist type individual that was just like, you N-words can't walk through our community. And we got hit by a car. One of us got hit by a car from them trying to run over protesters as we just peacefully walked. So the anger, a lot of people are angry at us. Like a lot of
Why do you think they're angry at you, Frank?
What I found out as we were marching, once we got to Indiana has, well, Knox, Indiana is the home of the KKK. Warsaw, Indiana is the home of the Aryan Brotherhood. So racism is still well and alive in the Midwest, and we just didn't know it. So when we walked through Indiana, a lot of those people just didn't like the fact that we were black. I think a lot of them, the other ones were, you have prejudice and you have racism. The prejudiced individuals, they like black people. They like Obama. They like their friend at work. They like a few black people they've associated with, but they think the rest of black people are what they see on TV. So I honestly, not to make excuses for them, I honestly think a lot of those people had heard like negative things about Black Lives Matter or heard that we were going to riot and burn things down. And they honestly had their energy towards, you're not coming into our community to do that. But unfortunately, we weren't there to do that. So they were attacking us for no reason. You know what I mean? A lot of them were Trump supporters with Trump signs, and they would be out there with their Trump signs, like antagonizing us, like anti-protesting us, while we just literally walk down the street.
Frank, with the way you describe this and shot and run over by a car and racial epithets and slurs and, you know, just get out, you don't belong here, not us. It sounds so much like some of the marches that took place in the South so long ago. The late John Lewis used to march. Frank Nitti, that sounds much the same sort of climate that you were marching in all the way to Washington, D.C. How much has changed?
In those areas, it was that exact climate. That was the saddest thing. I felt like we had to tap into the ancestors that had went like into those restaurants and sat there and just got beat up and food throw at them, and they just kind of took it. So I told the group, it was the saddest part was I had to tell these group of people to take it. You know what I mean? To let them call you the N-word, to let them criticize you, to let them talk crazy about you, to just take it and continue to walk. That was literally the hardest part about the trip. And to see that all these people were like in this 1960s mentality in these cities where white people are just within themselves. Like, for example, the white man that shot at us, it was all on video. We were unaware what was going on. We thought a tire blew out. That's how unaware we were until we heard the second gunshot. And then my friend told him, we'll be peaceful and leave. And then they shot him. That guy didn't get charged. They arrested him and let him go.
Still?
And it's like, yeah, in the city that he lives in, like, there's only a few thousand people, you know what I mean? So those people know each other. Those white people know each other. So they're allowed to be racist. Like, a lot of white people know a racist person. A lot of white people know a racist person. And their dad, their brother, their cousin, their friend, and they never hold them accountable for their racism. They allow them to be racist. They don't challenge them to not be racist. They don't tell them they're wrong for being racist. They allow them to. And that's the problem. Like, white people know. We never knew it, that Knox, Indiana was home of the KKK, but a lot of white people knew that.
White people know. Frank Nitti Sensabaugh is our guest. He walked all the way to Washington, D.C. He faced America in 2020, which sounds eerily similar to America in 1965. And when he got there, he gave a speech on the anniversary of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. What did Frank Nitti have to say? Our conversation with him continues along with you at 1-800-642-1234 or ideas at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network. What does Black Lives Matter mean to you? Now, 1-800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network, and I'm Lee Rayburn. Our guest is Frank Nitti Sensabaugh. He's an activist and community leader in Milwaukee. He's been at the forefront of the Black Lives Matter movement and walked all the way to Washington, D.C., facing things that would have made many of us fight back or turn away. He made it to our nation's capital and spoke at the rally last weekend among tens of thousands. And if you'd like to talk to him or ask him a question about where we go as a community together, 1-800-642-1234. Marion Pewaukee, you're on the Ideas Network with Frank Nitti this morning. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Frank. I met you, and first of all, I want to thank you very, very much for what you're doing for the BLM movement. Are we still calling it Black Lives Matter or Black Liberation? movement or anyway. So I'd like you to comment on that, please. But thank you so much for what you're doing. I consider myself now, after getting educated on the right channels in public television, I thank them and support them and certain TV, you know, stations. But thank you for everything you're doing. Anti-racist. I'm an anti-racist. Call out anyone that does something wrong. And I firmly believe, from everything I've read, that as far as the media that I listen to, that you folks have been the non-violent, peaceful protesters. Thank you again very much. I met you in Whitefish Bay on that one little walk, and I appreciate being a small, small part of it, but you're a great part of it.
I really appreciate that, but I think that you're a large part of it, because without, like, people of non-color supporting the movement, no one would care. Like, black people, we've been marching forever, but now all people are marching for black lives. And I tell people all the time, it's not like they're going to write laws for black people. When they write the laws, it's going to be for all people. So even if you support, like, Black Lives Matter, they're going to write laws for all people to change things. It's just that we're trying to highlight the individuals that are being targeted the most. Well, as far as, like, the Black Lives Matter versus Black Liberation, I like the Black Liberation movement. They have, like, a nice ring to it. A lot of times I'm affiliated with Black Lives Matter, but we haven't had a conversation for me to technically say I'm a chapter of Black Lives Matter, even though they've endorsed me and said that they support us and that they'll call me Black Lives Matter as well. So it's a love relationship with them. But for me, it's the revolution. This is a revolution. This is something that's not going to stop until we get changed. That's why it looks a little different. We used to march over someone dying every 3 or 4 months when we found out through mass media that someone died. We would march for them. But now the marches are running into the next police death. So it's a little bit different now. You see that the marches are continuing, and then someone else dies, and then it's an uproar again. But the marches had never died down. So this time around, it's a little different than everything that we've done before. And people are tired. This is the time where people are going to continue to fight for change. No one's going to stop until they get change. There's a lot of different methods. Me, I'm peaceful. And I don't say anything about the way that other people do it. But if you ask me my opinion, I think that we need to be able to have dialogue and conversations in this country. I've had dialogue with white supremacist groups. I've had dialogue with Republicans. I've had dialogues with anti-protesters, individuals that felt like we were doing stuff for the wrong reason. And conversation in this country, once you talk, you kind of realize that we have more in common and more apart.
Right.
I think those conversations have led to some type of change already amongst the people.
Jim from Watertown called, couldn't stay. He said the way to make a difference is inclusion. And it seems to be the same way, Frank, that if you open up and start talking to somebody, you're going to start realizing all the things you have in common. And if you never open your mouth, you'll never know.
Exactly. And we're very inclusive. Black Lives Matter doesn't mean you have to be black. It just means that you believe that black people are being treated unfairly in this country. No one should be treated unfairly. White people are being treated unfairly. Mexicans are being treated unfairly. I always compare it to like a table. Some people get bigger crumbs than us, but we're all getting crumbs. So at a certain point, you have to realize that, yeah, we know that white people are being killed by the police, and we would march for them too. That's why we want white people to march with us. But if we actually were to help the situation with African Americans and the way we're killed in this country by the police, or the way that we're arrested by the police and the excessive force that they use. Once we change those things, then it'll change for everybody, for all the other people that are going through it as well. But you have to get behind the group that's being targeted the most. And right now that's African Americans.
Frank Nitti, our guest, a community leader from Milwaukee who walked all the way to Washington, D.C., and once you got there last weekend, Frank, and you were among the tens of thousands who marched on our nation's capital on the anniversary of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech, you had a chance to address the movement. What did you say? And this is after, you know, you're facing racism all the way across the country. This is after a friend gets shot and somebody gets run over. This is after having things thrown at you along the way. I can't imagine if I had a chance to speak what would come out of my mouth.
Well, they gave us 2 minutes, and I was like, I didn't know how much time I would have. I was just honored to speak. They had let me know I was asked to speak, like, while we were marching, almost around, like, day 17 or 18 or so. So I was just, like, excited. I'm always one that doesn't prepare for something like that. I like to tap into the energy around me and my own emotions and how I feel from the energy of everyone. So for me, I just let my heart pour out, and I just let them know that we can't stop doing what we're doing. My grandkids can't march for the same things my grandfather marched for. We have to change these things. We've been marching for the same things for black people over and over and over for years. And my other key elements was to get organized. We have to organize as activists so we can bring attention to families that need our help. George Floyd was murdered by the police and the whole world knew about it. But Joseph Mensa killed three people. He killed Jay Anderson. He killed Antonio Gonzalez. And he killed Alvin Cole. And no one knew about it. One officer killing three people in 5 years. So those three families, sometimes it's kind of hard for a family when you lose your loved one and no one knows about it. Then you watch another family that loses their loved one from the police and the whole world is fighting for them. So once we get organized as activists around the country, we'll be able to come to each other's aids and come to different family members' aids whenever they need our help and bring attention to the stuff that media wants to ignore. And then the vote. We have to vote. That was a key point as well. Unless we vote, we won't be able to change things. Now that they see all these different people, white, black, Mexican, LGBTQ, young, old, you know, a 5-year-old and a 95-year-old marches with us. When you see all these different people marching, now you see voters. All these different races of people, now you see voters. And if you can get them to vote one way, that's politically scary. Politicians are people that want to keep their job. And they'll do the things that they need to do to keep their job as long as they know that voters support them and support the ideas that they have. So a lot of times Black Lives Matter wasn't something that people wanted to support or that, you know, on the Republican side, like Trump people, Trump individuals that support Trump don't want to support Black Lives Matter, which is weird to me because I don't think it should have became a political thing. Black people are Republican and Democrat. It's like, does Black Republican lives matter? You know what I mean? Like, there are Black Republicans, whether people believe it or not. So for it to become a political agenda to separate the world into, like, racial categories where we're going to say, okay, well, we're not going to support that politically because it's Black people, or we are going to support that politically as Black people, is the problem that we're facing in the future of this country. So now it's become a voting thing, and it's very important that we vote for individuals that support change for Black people.
Well, social justice and politics have always been intertwined in the United States of America, but if past is prologue, then you know how history plays out, and how the history is viewed down the road, and you know what to expect. We have just a few seconds here, Frank, but I want to thank you for your time this morning. I want to thank you for your work in your community, our community, and I want to consider this the start of a longer conversation about where we go from here as a state of Wisconsin and as a people. So for all the walking that you've done, for all the marching that you've done, for the activism in Milwaukee, Frank Nitti, thanks for joining us this morning and looking forward to the opportunity to catch up with you again, sir. Thank you so much.
Definitely would love to come on again. And anytime. That was a quick half an hour.
I feel the same way. I'm looking at the clock and I'm thinking, you know.
A lot of stuff I didn't get to talk about. But no, so I would love to come back. And hopefully the people that have heard me would love for me to come back as well. I just want to clear up things about Black Lives Matter. We're peaceful for the most part. And I just want people to know that we love everybody. And we're just trying to come together as one people.
But you're calling for change. And change needs to come.
Yeah, change is hard to get, too.
We got to work. Frank Nitti Sensabaugh, activist, community leader, and our guest here on The Morning Show. Just ahead, we spent an hour talking about Kenosha with you and what it means to the rest of this country right now. We'll have three faith leaders from the community joining us and your input as well. Presidential appearances in Kenosha, candidates making their appearance today. But how do we move forward in southeastern Wisconsin? I'm Lee Rayburn. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.